turn ordinary Android smartphones bought off Amazon into orbiting satellites. PhoneSats. Jasper heard about NASA's PhoneSat project from a friend, and he was so excited about it that he left his native Australia the minute he finished college.
I graduated on Thursday and flew over here on Friday and started work on Friday afternoon.
Now, Jim, on the other hand, he just got his first iPhone last month. So when he heard about PhoneSat...
Well, I guess my initial reaction is, what's that? Sure, I'd be glad to work on it, but I'll have to figure out what it is.
The idea of PhoneSat is simple. Satellites are big machines custom built for things like communication and navigation. They use expensive electronics designed to work in space. Modern smartphones are a lot cheaper and can do a lot of the same things. So why not just turn one into a satellite? Jim had his doubts.
I was really skeptical at first because I said, okay, there's a reason why NASA develops these expensive satellites and tests them extensively.
Jim knew the PhoneSats needed to survive extreme temperatures and radiation. Could a smartphone really operate in such a harsh environment? Jasper thought so.
The mobile phones are designed to be thrown around the room and for people to drop them in water. And, you know, they're really robust bits of technology.
Jasper Wolf, Jim Cockrell, and the rest of the team got the PhoneSats ready for launch. They added extras like plus-size batteries and a powerful transmitter. They put it all in a metal case the size of a Kleenex box. But the phones were still ordinary smartphones. They still had games on them.
We played around with Angry Birds on the ground.
Did anyone bother to delete Angry Birds before you launched it?
Actually, that's a good question.
Three.
Go Antares.
One. Ignition start. Liftoff of the Antares A1 test mission.
The PhoneSats hitched a ride on the very first flight of a commercial rocket called Antares, which NASA hopes will soon be resupplying the International Space Station.
Within the first orbit after being released from the launch vehicle, we started receiving signals.
That signal could mark big changes in the satellite business. Peter Platzer is CEO of NanoSatisfy, a startup company that's about to launch a small satellite into space using money raised on the crowdfunding site Kickstarter. He sees a world in which satellites aren't just owned by powerful corporations and governments.
The same way the computer morphed into becoming a personal computer, we could see a future where the satellite morphs into becoming a personal satellite.
The satellite he's working on will actually take apps. Users can program them here on Earth and beam them up into orbit.
I think whenever you create this flexible platform that you let people program and decide what their own use is, it becomes really, really hard to predict where the combined creative genius of mankind will lead that platform.
The PhoneSats will eventually run out of juice. But Jim's going to keep working with Jasper and the young team. He finds it inspirational.
They don't know what they can't do. You know, they haven't been told what's not possible. And that really opens up a lot of creative thinking that somehow tends to go away with time.
Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WILL. David and Charles Koch control what is believed to be the nation's biggest privately held company, Koch Industries. They share a strong libertarian bent against high taxes and government regulation, and in recent years they've plunged deeply into partisan politics. They've supported Tea Party Republicans who have beliefs that often coincide with their own. Recent reports confirmed by NPR have revealed they're interested in acquiring the Chicago-based Tribune Company's newspapers, what would likely be a fire sale price. More on that story from NPR's David Folkenflik.
The Koch brothers' vast holdings include huge investments in energy, manufacturing, mining, and commodities. But they're known these days for their politics. Matt Welch is editor of Reason, a libertarian magazine. David Koch sits on its parent foundation. The Welch says he thinks they've never met.
Charles and David Koch have been for the last 40 years, 40-plus years, the most significant backers of libertarian-based organizations and philanthropies in the country. It's not even close. It is Charles and David Koch, you know, 100, everybody else, 2.
David Koch, the younger one at 72, ran for vice president on the libertarian ticket in 1980. More recently, the Koch brothers raised millions to elect Tea Party candidates and other Republicans, and raise even more for ads opposing President Obama's re-election last year. As a result, they have become a target of liberals.
You really can't get away from the Koch brothers. They're becoming way too ubiquitous. Their names pop up in every scummy political scandal, one after another.
That's MSNBC's Rachel Maddow. And whether one thinks she was being fair or not, the Koch brothers are dogged by their strong political identity. In a former life, Matt Welch was an assistant editorial pages editor at the Los Angeles Times, the largest paper in Tribune. He says, good luck to the Kochs.
It would be such a culture clash, inevitably, between them and the newsroom there, that it would be kind of open conflict for a long time. I would have a hard time imagining how they get out of that, how they calm that down in a productive way.
Two people with close ties to Tribune confirm that Brothers Fancy has now turned to the company's newspapers, which can be obtained for far less money than they would have cost a decade ago. James O'Shea is a former top editor at both the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune.
I think with the Koch brothers, people will probably look at it and say, well, okay, here are people with a lot of money, and maybe they'll actually invest in the place, and maybe they'll have some ideas about how we diversify our revenue base and get away from this heavy, heavy, heavy reliance on advertising.
Yet O'Shea says he wonders whether the Kochs really view the papers as a financial investment.
I don't think anybody's going to object too much if the Koch brothers buys the Chicago Tribune and has a libertarian kind of right-wing editorial page.
The question is how the brothers would treat news coverage. They set up the site KochFacts.com to take on press coverage they don't like, and several reporters told NPR they had felt the sting of coordinated campaigns to harass them. Take David Sassoon, the publisher of Inside Climate News, a small not-for-profit news outfit that just won a Pulitzer Prize. A few years ago, it published a series of pieces on the possible winners and losers were the Keystone XL pipeline to be built from Alberta, Canada, to Nebraska.
We wrote a story saying they're positioned to be winners if the pipeline is built because it will lead to higher prices for tar sands and a boom in general that will lift all boats.
The Kochs pressured the Reuters news agency to stop distributing the site's articles, though they identified no specific mistakes to correct. The brothers took out ads against Sassoon on Facebook and Google, too.
They included my photograph in these ads. They used my name in these ads and really came after us in a way that I've never experienced before.
A spokeswoman for the Kochs, Missy Colmia, said they respect the independence of the Tribune papers, though she did not confirm the brothers' interest in buying them. Before 1960, the family that owned the LA Times propelled Richard Nixon and other Republicans to office. Reason Magazine's Matt Welch asks, why shouldn't the Kochs?
I mean, the LA Times were the Republican kingmakers of California and therefore at least part of the country for nearly a century. It's incredible, that history.
Tribune is to send out formal documents to potential buyers next month. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
You're listening to WILL AM 580. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Chris Berube. And when we hear stories like that from NPR that are deeply reported, that are breaking all sorts of news, that kind of stuff doesn't come cheap. Here at WILL, we're a partnership between us, NPR, American Public Media, the BBC, lots of people. So if you value the kind of deep reporting that you hear every day on this station, call 217-244-9455 or give at willpledge.org. Help push us over the edge. We are at 108,486. We've only got $11,500 to go. We can do this together, and your pledge will make the difference immediately in pushing us towards our goal. 217-244-9455, willpledge.org. I'm supposed to be pledging again tomorrow. I got to be honest, I don't want to do it. Let's see if we can end this drive today by reaching our goal of $120,000. Thank you very much to Holly in Champaign, who gave a very generous pledge, and Robert and Wendy in Champaign also gave a very generous monthly pledge. If you don't think you can afford, say, $120 right now, maybe $10 a month will fit into your schedule, or $20 a month will fit into your budget. We have all sorts of payment options that will be convenient for you. Just give us a call, 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org if you don't want to hear me make this kind of pitch again. This is WILL.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Strategic Farm Marketing, Champaign; KC Summers, Mattoon; and Jarman Center, Tuscola. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 26th of April, 2013. It's the birthday of the man who said, "The truth springs from arguments among friends." He also said, "The life of man is of no greater importance to the universe than that of an oyster." The philosopher David Hume, born Edinburgh, Scotland, 1711. He was a librarian. He wrote a 6-volume History of England. It was a bestseller, gave him the independence to write philosophy. He wrote A Treatise of Human Nature, Inquiries Concerning Human Understanding. He was a strict skeptic, questioned all knowledge derived from the senses. He said, "Beauty is no quality in things themselves. It exists merely in the mind which contemplates them, and each mind perceives a different beauty." David Hume said, "Reading and sauntering and lounging and dozing, which I call thinking, is my supreme happiness. He is happy whose circumstances suit his temper, but he is more excellent who can suit his temper to his circumstance." It's the birthday of another famous philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, born Vienna, 1889, whose colleague Bertrand Russell described him as a true genius, passionate, profound, intense, and dominating. He was the youngest in a very wealthy family of 9 children, 3 of whom committed suicide. Wittgenstein said that the study of philosophy rescued him from years of loneliness and wanting to die. He was particularly interested in language. He wrote, "The limits of my language are the limits of my mind. All I know is what I have words for." It's the birthday of Audubon, John James Audubon, born Haiti, 1785, to a French naval officer and plantation owner, and a Creole chambermaid. He grew up in France. From his early childhood, he loved birds, headed to America when he was 18 to escape the Napoleonic Wars. He was fascinated by all the new American birds he saw, began to study them. He banded birds to study their migration. He fell in love with a woman named Lucy Bakewell. He married her, opened a general store in Kentucky on the Ohio River. He wasn't good at business, so he was thrown into prison for debt, and that was when he set out on a quest to catalog and draw every bird in North America. Traveled from New Orleans to the Everglades, from Niagara Falls, the Great Lakes, to Newfoundland, down the Mississippi, all the way to Texas, and published his masterpiece, Birds of America, with 435 life-sized, hand-colored pictures. And it's the birthday of the man who said, "Write your heart out," Bernard Malamud, born in Brooklyn,